What is it like to care about someone bad, someone evil?
You know, I almost remember that day like it was yesterday. It replays in my mind a lot. I was on shift that night. We got the call over the radio. It was time to wake him up. So I stood there and watched him get ready and fix his hair, put his suit on, put his watch on. He got dressed to the nines as best as he could. And we all knew that it was coming close. He sort of knew that too before he walked into the death house. And he turned around and said goodbye and said that we were all his friends.
That's the sound of the execution of Saddam Hussein. He was hanged in 2006 following his trial in Baghdad. And Adam Rogerson was an American soldier, one of the Super 12 assigned to guard Saddam Hussein during his trial. These were young men, many just out of basic training, who spent months alone in close quarters with a man the rest of the world reviled as the Butcher of Baghdad. They were there at the hanging and for the violent aftermath. As you can hear, Adam is still haunted by what happened. Will Barden-Wepper was also serving in Iraq at the time. He was an airborne ranger, and he remembers wondering what such young, inexperienced soldiers were doing guarding such a high-value prisoner and what effect that might have on them. Charles Monroe Kane talked with Adam and with Will, who's just come out with a book about the Super 12. It's called The Prisoner and the Palace.
You know, when they went over there, I think they were expecting to kind of do what soldiers expect to do, which is get into combat situations and potentially engage with and kill bad guys. I mean, that's why a lot of these guys joined to begin with.
Sure, a lot of these guys were hooked up during 9/11, right?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of them joined out of a sense of patriotism. And yeah, so I think when they got this assignment, they had a mixed response. On the one hand, you know, I think they were intrigued by the idea that they would be with Saddam Hussein, but I think some of them were kind of bummed out that they weren't going to be outside the wire, sort of mixing it up with the insurgents, and that they'd be kind of stuck in one place.
I was a little surprised that these guys didn't have special training. I figured some bunch of high-level CIA guys would be guarding Saddam Hussein, but some kids, they're kids from like Kentucky and Ohio. That seems really strange to me.
Yeah, no, I mean, they were in some cases not far removed from basic training.
Some of them were 18.
Yeah, I mean, it was remarkable. They weren't special operators. They weren't, you know, CIA clandestine service personnel. I mean, they were just basic young soldiers. And then that combined with kind of the intimacy of their interactions, I think, was what really struck me about how unusual this was.
They were not allowed to tell anyone, right?
Correct. I mean, that's one of the things I think that made this mission particularly challenging was that, you know, here they were sitting a few feet away from the most wanted dictator, you know, on the planet.
Right.
And then they would get on the phone with their families, like we can fortunately do nowadays from these deployments on occasion. And they would, you know, have to invent essentially a cover story. And their family would ask them what they're doing. And they'd have to say, oh, you know, I'm pulling guard duty in a guard tower. It's pretty boring. There's nothing really exciting going on here. And you can imagine how much some of them would have liked to have shared, you know, with their families and with their loved ones, the truth of what they were doing.
We came out of the 101st. We actually didn't know that we were going to be Dawn, the Super 12. It's sort of something that we just fell into. It was kind of crazy when we found out that we were taking over this mission. They hand-selected us out of our company. We all had certain skills. I was 22.
What was it like the first time you met Saddam Hussein?
People have souvenirs with his, you know, they're bringing home money with his face on it, and you're like, wow, you know, oh, that's kind of cool, but nothing could prepare you for meeting him for the first time. I mean, he was sleeping in his cell. It was pitch black, and you sort of had to just navigate your way through, and you could just hear him sleeping. Once he heard us come down, he got up to use the bathroom, and I'm just standing there like, I can't believe that Saddam Hussein is taking a leak right here. I mean, this is the first time I ever meet him, and you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, just, totally, man. It's crazy. It's surreal as hell.
It was just weird.
Did you say hi to him?
Oh, no. I mean, it was kind of an intimidating moment. I didn't know what to say. You know, I just kept quiet and just, you know, the dude was sleeping. So I respected that a little bit. And I was just there to make sure no one tried to get at him.
I got to ask you, I mean, you're a 22-year-old American from Ohio, and you got Saddam Hussein, who's not a 22-year-old American from Ohio, and you're alone with him. What did you guys talk about?
Well, right off the bat, it was sort of, we were sort of just feeling each other out. And what I mean by that is, you know, he would be sitting there staring at us, and we would be sitting there staring right back at him, and we had to break through some sort of, it was a lot of staring, because, I mean, what do you say to this guy? I mean, when it's, you know, nighttime, and he's relaxing, smoking a cigar, and just wanting to BS, you know, we would listen to the radio. We would sit by his little electric heater. He talked about his kids, you know, and he always told us that he was getting out and he was going to escape or someone was going to come get him. And we would just laugh and, you know, smirk at him like, yeah, okay, you know. But, yeah, I mean, we would reminisce, and he spoke perfect English. I don't know, we would pass the time. He was passing his time, and we were passing ours.
Now, I don't want to be boring, but I think there's a kind of a question I want to ask here, because I was like, oh, they guarded Saddam Hussein. Yeah, there's a monitor, they're behind some cement thing, they're looking at him, and he's in solitary confinement. But that's not how they guarded him, right? How did they guard him? How did it work?
Well, you're right. They needed to be, the way they described it to me was essentially within lunging distance of him, pretty much at all times.
You said lunging distance?
Lunging, yeah.
Sounds like we have a toddler. You got to be within lunging distance.
And it was, you know, ostensibly the primary objective was to just keep him safe from others that would be either trying to harm him or trying to free him. But in reality, I think also the concern was that he would do something to himself. And this was not too long after the Abu Ghraib scandal. And I think the Americans were very paranoid that if you bring Saddam into trial one day and he has a black eye, even if he did that to himself, you know, in the shower or something,
Sure. Immediately
the word's going to get out in the Arab world that he's being abused. And so
Sure. There
was a priority placed on ensuring that didn't happen, which required them to be in very close proximity to him at all times.
And not just close proximity to him, lunging distance, but one at a time. So, like, you're this kid from Ohio, right? And you're suddenly, like, arm lengths away from this dictator for how many? 8-9 hours in a row by yourself. That must have been a powerful experience.
You know, the instructions were essentially to keep your distance, and you're not supposed to go out of your way to engage him in conversation. But at the same time, it's kind of inevitable that if you're just sitting in a small concrete cell for 8 hours and there's nothing else to do, that there will be some dialogue. And what they experienced was that he would gradually, you know, look up from whatever he was doing. He read a lot, he wrote a lot, and he would ask them questions and kind of draw things out of them. And then, you know, as time went by, there would be more conversation, and they got to know a little bit more about each other.
Wow. They created a relationship.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's really no other way to describe it as that.
Can you give me one example? The one that I think the most affected my heart, if I can say that, was the relationship between Saddam Hussein and one of the guards you named Doc Ellis. Can you tell me about that relationship?
When Doc Ellis got word that his brother was dying back home in St. Louis and he would have to leave on emergency leave, he made an unannounced visit to Saddam's cell to let Saddam know that he wasn't going to be there for a week because he didn't want Saddam to be upset at his absence. Such was the nature of their relationship.
Wow.
Saddam got up after Doc Ellis had told him why he was going to be gone. embraced him and said, "Don't worry, you're losing one brother, but I will always be your brother."
It is clear to me, it is very clear to me that these men, and whatever care means, cared about Saddam Hussein in some way. Mm-hmm. Okay? You didn't get to interview Saddam, of course. Do you think he cared about them?
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Was that embrace to Doc Ellis authentic?
I think they did care for him. And I think that one of the reasons for that is that it's a lot more difficult to play a role in the execution of someone that you've come to see as a human being.
Right.
You see them sleep, you see them bathe, you see them eat, you interact with them. Not only do you interact with them, but you've experienced him to be a sort of a charming, vulnerable older man. And that's more difficult than, you know, shooting at an anonymous enemy target from 200 meters. You know, there was a quote in the book that if our helicopter went down in Baghdad, you know, I'm convinced he wouldn't have hurt me. Such was, you know, the nature of our relationship. And some of the soldiers genuinely believed that.
Do you think he cared about you?
That's a great question. If something would have happened, maybe there's some people in the squad that he might not have cared about as much for, but if something were to happen and we would get overrun, I always thought that he would show mercy on me. So, not that I was anything special, and maybe he wouldn't have, but I always thought in my head, maybe, just maybe, he would. And it was really crazy one night, you know, he was smoking a Cohiba. That was his choice cigar that we would give to him. He would have a certain amount of Cohibas that we would give him a day. He was looking through photos, and I was sort of just checking out what he was doing. And there were pictures of Fidel Castro and him on a boat. And I was like, oh, you know, that's kind of cool. I'm like, you know, you guys hung out? He's like, yeah, you know, he's the one who got me to start smoking Cohibas. And I was like, wow, like, this is crazy. He never talked to us about the evil stuff that he did. It was all, he was almost, I got the vibe, and this is just me, that he was almost sorry.
Now, of course, as we're talking about all this, and as this relationship is changing with these men and with Saddam and this crazy situation they're in, there's a trial going on. Tell us about the trial.
You know, he knew his country well enough to know that no amount of sophisticated legal argument would save him. And so what he did was, I think he viewed the trial as an opportunity to kind of rehabilitate his image in the eyes of his followers. And I think as he was an extreme narcissist, and when he got pulled out of that rabbit hole looking, you know, like a bum, I think that did a tremendous amount of damage to his, what he saw as his prestige. And so from that moment on, he resolved to present himself to his people as this defiant leader, a strong leader. And so that's really what he used the trial to do, was to project that image.
You know, during the trials, he accused some of the guards of torture. While they were there. How did the guards who would be starting a relationship with this man, how did they react to this feeble old man they were taking care of, now this defiant, angry man accusing them of things that weren't true?
Yeah. I mean, there's an account from one of the guards that he was, on the same day he was in court waving about how he had been mistreated by the Americans, he got into the elevator to bring him back down into the subterranean cell where they were holding him. And he laughed and he said, "Hey, don't worry about that. That was basically just for the cameras. But, wow. You know, you treat me great."
The trial ended, we all know, with an execution, a hanging. Could you tell me about that day, what happened at the execution?
You know, I almost remember that day like it was yesterday. It replays in my mind a lot. I was on shift that night, and we all knew that it was coming close. you know, we broke his radio so he couldn't hear. And we got the call over the radio. It was time to wake him up. And we did, and he knew. So I stood there and watched him get ready and fix his hair, put his suit on, put his watch on. He got dressed to the nines as best as he could. Once that was done, I left him, and then we all had to mentally prepare for what was about to go down. And that was pretty intense, because we figure if someone is gonna come get him or he's planning to escape, he's gonna do it now. So that was a very intense time, just cleaning your weapons and making sure everything was on point with yourself. Yeah, once we got there and he said goodbye to us, and I mean, then
I'm sorry. What did he say to you? You personally, how did he say goodbye to you?
It was very sad once the commotion was over and we knew we were in somewhat of a safe zone. No one was going to come get him, and he sort of knew that too before he walked into the death house, and he turned around and said goodbye and said that we were all his friends. Some of us were crying and he was sad, but just for that split second to see him in an emotional state, it was crazy. We've been in firefights, we've been through IEDs, but at that, nothing could prepare you for that type of situation.
What happened after the hanging, immediately after?
They worked so hard to comport themselves in a professional, dignified manner and to treat him the way they were supposed to, and then it kind of all went to hell. And I mean, the execution itself kind of just resembled a disorganized sort of mob scene. And then in the moments after the execution, when Saddam's body was getting mistreated, you know, they were forced to essentially stand there and watch that.
I think that I was, I really didn't know what to feel. I've never seen anything like that in my life. You know, it was just like, wow, that, I mean, it was like Wild Wild West to me, like I've only seen this in movies, but to hear it all go down, and it was intense. I was more protective than I was sad, because when you're asked to protect someone like that, and no one's supposed to hurt him, and you just have that drilled in your brain, and it's easy to influence a 22-year-old. When you see him kicking and spitting on his body, I just had more respect in the presence of death, I guess.
Another one of the soldiers would speak very candidly about any number of insurgents that he had killed, and he didn't have any real regret or remorse about that. But this experience had a profound impact on him, and so you have to step back and say, okay, well, why was it that he was able to kill from a distance and almost joke about it offhandedly? But here we are with essentially the worst of our enemies, and playing a role in that particular death really hurt him and troubled him. Hutch later reflected, "I feel like I have to explain why it bothered me so much for an American to be upset. But for us to stand by and let them treat another human being that way, I thought that's what we were over here to stop, the treatment like that. I truly felt that I was just as guilty as anybody else. I've never really had a conscience about anything I've ever done over here. As far as humanity goes, I've seen some pretty bad things. But my job had never before said that I had to stand there and watch people spit on and kick a person's body. And you know what? I'm glad I feel that way. I really am. Because if I didn't feel that way, I would think something was wrong with me."
So would you say that, I mean, I don't want to use this word lightly, but are you traumatized by what happened in Iraq?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. I live with those demons every day. But don't get it twisted. Like, he was tried for his crimes, and that is the judgment that they came down with. And I'm not saying that he didn't deserve it. I'm saying that as a 22-year-old soldier, maybe I wasn't ready for that. I think though I wasn't the one who dropped the floor out, sometimes I feel like I did.
Adam Rogerson was one of the soldiers in Iraq who guarded Saddam Hussein. Will Barden-Wepper's book about them is called The Prisoner and the Palace. And Charles Monroe Kane talked with both of them.